from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Affirmative action was a fight from the start. After all these years, the fight was still on yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court. Should race be a factor in college admissions? In this year, when race is being called out as a factor in nearly everything on campus, it's a loaded question. Oral arguments before the High Court yesterday, some tough shots taken. This hour on point, the University of Texas case and the Supreme Court on affirmative action again. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Where are we as a nation on affirmative action? Mission accomplished, more work to be done. Is it working? Is it getting in the way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Joan Biskupic, legal affairs editor at Reuters, the author of three books on three Supreme Court justices, Sotomayor, Scalia, and O'Connor. She was in the courtroom yesterday for oral arguments in the case of Fisher versus the University of Texas. Joan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you with us today. Here, just to, for the sound of her voice, is the Abigail Fisher of Fisher versus University of Texas with a brief statement in front of the Supreme Court yesterday outside saying she was grateful to be there making her case.
Like most Americans, I don't believe that students should be treated differently based on their race. Hopefully, this case will end racial classifications and preferences in admissions at the University of Texas.
Joan Biskupic, what is going on with this case? It's complicated. It's not exactly straightforward. What is being put to the court? What are they being asked to decide?
They're being asked to decide something specific to the University of Texas at Austin, but also to sort of give some new guidelines for what will happen nationally for programs aimed at fostering racial diversity on all campuses. The Texas program, just so your listeners know, is a two-prong one. Most of the students are admitted to that flagship campus under a program that they call the top 10%. That means that the top 10% of all the graduating high school classes are guaranteed admission. But the second part of the program is what's actually in dispute, and that's the way that about 25% of freshmen are admitted to the Austin campus. And for that, university officials look at a range of characteristics, their leadership, their family background, and one of those characteristics is race. And what Abigail Fisher's claim is targeting is that program, saying that race should not be in the mix because in this situation, the University of Texas has not demonstrated that it needs that for campus diversity. That's her argument. And it goes back to the 1978 landmark decision in Bakke that endorsed affirmative action for the first time and said that universities can consider race as one of many factors to ensure educational diversity on campus.
Now, this case, though, Fisher's come to the court before. This is not the first time she's stood on the steps of the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right, Tom. And I have to say, for a sequel, it was exciting, though, and it took some unpredictable turns. The first time the justices heard the case was back in October of 2012, and they took 8 months to decide it. And there was a lot of wrangling behind the scenes. And what they ended up doing in 2013 was essentially kicking it back to the lower court to say, we need some more, we need you to do a little bit more to review what the University of Texas's justification is for this, use a tougher standard on the university. Don't just let them say this was the only thing we could do. Look and see if the university had tried first some race-neutral approaches before turning to this program. And the lower court, the Fifth Circuit, came back and said, no, we still think it's a good program, and that's why it's back at the Supreme Court.
Before we get into yesterday, a little more history here, John, because it's interesting. I mean, there was a time in the University of Texas, Austin, this is the premier state school in that big state, had full-on affirmative action, right? That was knocked down before, and that's when they went to this top 10%, which weirdly, in its own way, is a kind of affirmative action program because, perhaps sadly, Texas schools, public schools, are so segregated that if you take the top 10% of every school or something like that, you're going to have plenty of all-black schools in there feeding African-American students and Latino and more into Austin.
You know, you hit right on it there, Tom. Texas has its unique history in terms of its court cases on affirmative action. In the mid-90s, a regional appeals court said that what Texas was doing with its affirmative action program was unconstitutional. So that's when Texas turned to the top 10%. And you're right that it brings more diversity, but what university officials say is that it doesn't bring sufficient diversity in part because of lingering patterns of segregation. They say that, you know, there just aren't enough minority students that are pulled in through that, and that's why they went then with the supplemental program. And, Tom, they didn't go to that supplemental program that uses race as a characteristic until after 2003, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in that University of Michigan case that allowed race to be used as a factor. So that's how Texas is defending this, and they're saying, look, it's a very modest approach. It doesn't even go as far as the University of Michigan Law School went, for example, but what Fisher's lawyers claim is that the top 10% should do it enough.
It's a thicket of out there, but it's so interesting. It's worth looking in there to see what's there. I mean, when they dropped their first affirmative action program after it got overruled, numbers of minority students plummeted at Austin. Then they went to this top 10% and they rose again. But, of course, that means it's only students or primarily students coming from these fully segregated schools, which tend to be, not middle or upper middle class African-American students. So part of this, University of Texas at Austin, I think, wants to have some of those sons of lawyers and doctors, let's say African-American lawyers and doctors and daughters, who are not necessarily in all black schools, but they still want them represented, too, on campus. Am I right?
You're right. The university is saying it wants diversity among its diverse students. And Justice Alito, during the Q&A yesterday at the Supreme Court, kind of hit them on that, saying, are you saying that there are certain students who come from the top 10% program who might be inferior or deficient somehow compared to what you really want? And the lawyer for the University of Texas was saying, no, that's not entirely it. We're looking for a range, and this is we're looking for a range of experiences and family backgrounds.
So what exactly are they looking at here? What do they have to decide? How narrowly or how broadly could they come out on this?
I think no matter what they do, I frankly think they're going to go narrowly, just because it's already such a tricky topic for them. And as you probably know, Tom, it was heard by only 8 of the justices. Elena Kagan, our most recent Supreme Court appointee, used to be U.S. Solicitor General, and as a member of the Obama administration, had been involved in some lower court litigation supporting the University of Texas. So she's not in the case. So it could, frankly, come down even to a 4-4 split. But you could tell from some of the concerns that our swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy raised yesterday that he's tentative on the Texas program, let alone going broadly in a way that would take on Bakke. But I should add that the same lawyers and conservative advocates who are backing Abigail Fisher have separately mounted a case against Harvard and the University of North Carolina, which directly attacks the 1978 Bakke ruling. And if they are successful, it would end affirmative action nationwide.
Bakke, that there is a value in diversity for the education of all students there. But they're looking at this fraction of a fraction of the students at University of Texas, Austin, where race consciousness comes in, not to the top 10% from all the public schools, but into this other 25% where that can be part of the mix. Fisher's camp says no to that. We had interesting comments from Antonin Scalia yesterday saying maybe they shouldn't even... Maybe they'd be better off if they're marginal in some way academically if they weren't at the University of Texas, Austin.
Well, you know, what he said was it was kind of surprising that he said it because that had not emerged during the oral arguments back in October of 2012. But I have to tell you, Tom, that kind of sentiment has been in the record from the start. What Justice Scalia said, and this is a quote, "There are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans," and then he used the phrase, he said, "some minorities might be better suited to less advanced or slower track schools." Now, that's pretty startling to hear a justice say that, but I do want to mention that that kind of argument had been in the record before from some academics. The University of Texas and many other academics really dispute it.
And from Clarence Thomas, the only African-American member of the High Court.
That's right. And Clarence Thomas actually put that kind of sentiment in his opinion when the first Fisher case was resolved. He wrote a concurring statement that said, setting aside the damage wreaked upon the self-confidence of those at these overmatched students, he was saying that some students just get in over their head at elite schools. This is Thomas contending this. He contends that there's no evidence that they learn more at a university like University of Texas than they would have learned at other schools for which they were better prepared. And I really want to say right now, though, that the University of Texas lawyer Greg Garr really countered Justice Scalia, saying, first of all, that students admitted through the supplemental program, the program that admits the 25% fare better. He said they fare better over time than those entering through the top 10%. And then he said something interesting at the very end of his comments to the court. He said, frankly, I don't think the solution to the problems with student body diversity can be to set up a system in which not only are minorities going to separate schools, they're going to inferior schools.
Chief Justice John Roberts seemed to question the whole premise that there was a value for everybody here in having diversity on campus. He said, what unique perspective does a minority student bring to a physics class?
That is so true, and that is so Chief Justice John Roberts. He is one of the most vocal opponents of racial remedies, of any kind of classifications based on race. We've seen it from the chief in voting rights, we've seen it in employment, and we've seen it before in educational settings.
The headlines, headlines coming out of that oral arguments that Justice's comments don't bode well for affirmative action. Do you agree, Joan, so far?
I would say there are two things to know. You got to know that yesterday they were suspicious, but Justice Kennedy, I think, has suggested an off-ramp that would avoid a decision striking down the program, and we can talk about that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about affirmative action before the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, race and college admissions at a time when race is a hot issue on U.S. college campuses. Joan Biskupic is with us, legal affairs editor at Reuters. She was in the Supreme Court yesterday at the Supreme Court for oral arguments in this case. Fisher versus the University of Texas. It is back again. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Do we still need affirmative action? What do you hear in this Texas case? Do we need affirmative action to keep our campuses diverse, the doors wide open? Does the Texas formula deserve to be upheld or knocked down? What about more widely? Do we need affirmative action to keep – is racial diversity on these campuses? If it declines, does it hurt everyone? Excuse me for – falling around there. A couple of pieces of tape I want to come to here. A little more from Abigail Fisher. And this was a video put out by the Project on Fair Representation. It's an advocacy group, conservative. It's been pushing this case from the beginning. Released another video interview of her last week before her case came for the second time to the high court.
Whether you're a male or a female or white or black, it shouldn't matter. It should come down to, you know, your grades and your activities and whether or not you deserve to get in. And it should be based on merit, and it shouldn't be based on any other external factors.
A little kind of smooth jazz in the background there, but it hasn't been smooth on campuses at all in this academic year, starting with the University of Missouri, where they had such an uproar, president out, chancellor out, hunger strike there that drove a lot of it. That student on hunger strike back in the autumn was Jonathan Butler, a week-long hunger strike. She said that just wasn't enough attention paid to racism on campus, let alone who gets in, but when they get there. Here he is at that time describing the racially charged environment as he saw it on the University of Missouri campus. Jonathan Butler.
The campus climate here at the University of Missouri has been unlivable since I was here as an undergraduate student. So I started here at the university in 2008. And in my first semester here, I had individuals write the N-word on my wall. I had white students who were literally physically assaulting me. The campus culture here is just not welcoming to people who aren't of the majority identity.
You might take that statement right there as an argument for why having diversity is important so that students understand it, get used to it, and learn from it. It is the reality of our country. Joan Biskupic, standby in Washington. With us also from Washington, Stuart Taylor joins us, writer and journalist focusing on legal and policy issues, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, National Journal contributing editor, former Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, and co-author This is not immaterial here, with Richard Sander of a book called Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Maybe one of the origins of Scalia's comments yesterday. Stuart Taylor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
And with me in the studio today is Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School, big thinker on race and race relations, author of For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. Randall Kennedy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got great minds at the table, and we want to explore this case, but our callers bring a lot to this, and we've got one right from Austin, where the university is, and I want to go right to him. Jim in Austin, Texas, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. Jim, what are you thinking about?
Hi, Tom. I'm white. My wife is black. Our son is mixed race here in Austin. He's applied at University of Texas, and I asked him, there's a young lady who lives down the street. Suppose she has exactly the same profile that you have, same grade, same place in class, and you get in and she doesn't. Do you think that's, how do you feel about that? And he said, I think that's unfair. I've been trying to explain to him why it's not unfair.
You mean if he got in instead of her because he had a mixed race parentage?
Well, and he's applying African. You check the boxes. Okay. African American is checked. So he's applied as African American. And he says, yes, I think it would be unfair for me to get in and her not to get in. And I've explained to him, you should think about it. In any specific situation, one person to one person, it's always going to seem unfair. Think about having 15,000 applicants. There might be 10 of that white young lady who lives down the street. There might be 10 of her applying for every one of you based on your family's background. So when you think statistically, it's not unfair. She already has in it. Statistically, she's already in a group that has the advantage.
Jim, stand by.
I'd like to know what your panel thinks about that.
Let me take you to Randall Kennedy. Randall Kennedy, this is right where America lives now. Families of all kinds of complexions, and you hear Jim's family and his son feels his mom is African-American. He describes himself as an African-American for admissions and doesn't feel right if he gets in, if that plays some factor in him getting in over, let's say, a white girl down the street.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think that the father made sense. That was a good point that the father made, but I think there's another point, and that is it's not about individual desert. It's not about the girl. It's not about the caller's son. It's about the mission of the university. It's about our society. We make decisions all the time about what our various institutions need to do to advance our society. Sometimes we focus on people who are, you know, especially good at, let's say, physics, or especially good at engineering. Sometimes we think that we need to have
violin
or people who are in state, people who are out of state, veterans. Gender. We're talking about racial affirmative action. The fact of the matter is that we take all sorts of social indicia into account in trying to form our strategic institutions to advance the mission of our society. One quick point. You earlier talked about the history of the University of Texas and the Supreme Court. One case that was not mentioned was the case of Heman versus Sweat, 1950. You know, until 1950, the University of Texas expressly excluded people of color. Heman Sweat applied to the University of Texas Law School, a black man, applied to the University of Texas Law School. The president of the University of Texas wrote him a letter and said, you know, you've got a really good record, and we would admit you except for one thing.
Wow.
You're black.
Wow.
So you are ineligible.
Until 1950.
The Supreme Court in Heman versus Sweat, one of its most important cases, a case leading up to Brown versus Board of Education, reversed that and said, you know, you cannot exclude this person on the basis of his race if you're not going to provide a separate but equal, you know, law school. So my point is, just recently in our lived experience, segregation is not long ago. Segregation is something that affected millions of people that are still alive. Is Abigail Fisher in the same boat as Heman Sweat? Absolutely not. Heman Sweat was excluded from the University of Texas because of his color, because the University of Texas viewed him and his kind as inferior. Is that the case with Abigail Fisher? Is anybody trying to stick it to Abigail Fisher because she's white? Absolutely not.
Stuart Taylor, what do you say to our caller Jim from Austin, Texas? He's white. His son's mother is African-American, and his son doesn't feel
right about the, a racial advantage, if there were one, among all the other pieces of his, what he brings in admissions?
Well, I have a complicated answer. I partly agree with Jim's son, and I partly agree with what both Jim and Randy said. The extent, I think it's unfair in this sense, and it's not the most important problem, but okay. I think it's unfair that almost all Asian Americans in the almost all elite schools in the country systematically discriminate against Asian Americans.
Why?
Because they are very well qualified, and they think they're going to have too many of them unless they discriminate against them, okay. and therefore the racial preferences. Number two, by and large, racial preferences, and I use those words because that's what people are calling affirmative action as a euphemism,
yep.
racial preferences tend to be the people who get them tend to be upper middle class blacks, and they are systematically preferred over less well-off and better qualified whites and Asians. Think about that for a minute. But I agree with Randy in this sense, and I guess I think the Sweat case was 65 years ago, and a lot's happened mm-hmm. since then. But I agree with Randy in this sense. Fairness is not really the best way to think about this, at least on a policy basis. Putting aside the very complicated constitutional arguments, is it working? The question is whether it's working. Is it good for the people it's supposed to benefit? If it's not good for the people it's supposed to benefit, then it's hard to defend it on any basis. It's always been advanced on the theory that it's good for the black and Hispanic kids. And I think, and the point of our mismatch book and the point of what Justice Scalia said, which horrified so many people, is that it's undisputed among social scientists a few things. You know, the bottom line, is it good, is hotly disputed. But a few things are not disputed. The preferences are not balance tippers. They're not tiebreakers. They're enormous. As a result, the academic preparation of black students at virtually all selective universities simply does not equip them to compete academically with their Asian and white classmates. This is not disputed. Maybe Randy will dispute it, but I don't think he disputed it in his book. And as a result, then the question is, a kid gets into the University of Texas. He's led to believe he's going to do very well. He's well qualified. He wants to be in pre-med. He takes chemistry. He's up against some of the best chemistry students in the country. And he's good, but he's not one of the best chemistry students in the country. He does badly in chemistry. He's told maybe you're not cut out to be a doctor. Even though if he'd gone to a school for which he was well qualified, where he could compete on an equal basis with his classmates, he'd do fine in chemistry, and he might go on to become a doctor.
I want to hold that thought. I'll bring it to you, Randall Kennedy. Joan Biskupic, you're listening. And Jim, in Austin, Texas, I hope that was a thorough airing for you. We've got more to say on it, but that's we brought in some big guns here for you and your son to have some lines of thought to chew on. But Joan,
Could I just add two things, Tom?
Yes, yes.
First, if Jim takes advantage of the preference, more power to him. I mean, you know, the rules are the rules, and I hope that he gets in the University of Texas, and I hope that he does well. Second, my co-author, Rick Sander, also has a mixed-race son, so he's been there.
Okay, it gets very personal. It's also national. Joan, is this colloquy that we just heard, does it reflect what the court heard yesterday? Is this the direction that the conversation went in?
No, it didn't, and it's interesting that the University of Texas sort of looks at the relevance of race through a different lens. You know, its lawyer, Gregory Garr, said, referring, I think, implicitly to some of the campus turmoil that you talked about, Tom,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is not the time to cut back on affirmative action programs. In its brief, it referred to the continuing relevance of race by some incidents such as the June shooting deaths of 9 black people in a church in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
It mentioned that the student body had pushed for the removal of a statue of Jefferson Davis to a less prominent site, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. So those kinds of atmospheric things that you're talking about now on this call and that the university highlighted a bit in its brief, they were not in the backdrop. They were in the backdrop, but they were not on the foreground. The foreground was more technical about, you know, what is the procedural posture of this case? Should it go back to a lower court for more factual findings? Where are we at? But there were, to acknowledge that, you know, some of the real-life consequences were there in the conversation, Chief Justice John Roberts did question the idea of whether it's working and how long should the court be permitting this. He noted that in the Supreme Court's ruling in Grutter versus Bollinger back in 2003, Justice O'Connor, who wrote the leading opinion allowing the continuation of race-based affirmative action on campus, suggested that it would run its course after 25 years. And the
we're sort of halfway there.
Yes. And in fact, the chief said something like, well, what have you gotten so far? And Greg Garr for the university said, you know, this is working. We are making progress.
Randall Kennedy, I want to come to Scalia's comments, but step back for a second to what you heard in the oral arguments yesterday, what you saw playing out before the court. What was most important yesterday? Where might it take the country in terms of court ruling or just staying out of it?
Well, I think there are a number of, you know, interesting things. One of the most interesting things you alluded to in your introduction, people often talk about the 10% plan as being race neutral.
In Texas.
In Texas. Justice Ginsburg has stated over and over again that, of course, that 10% plan is not race neutral.
Because those schools are so segregated.
Right. The reason why the 10% plan was put in place to begin with was as a response to the elimination of all affirmative action.
It has a veneer of neutrality, but everybody knows.
Everybody knows that the
whole diverse student body.
Yes. Question, do we truly want to eliminate race as a consideration, even if that would mean drastically lowering the number of racial minority students on our campuses? My argument would be absolutely not. We are still caught up in the effort to desegregate the United States. And we are trying that in all of our major institutions. You know, prior to the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, there had never been a black person in a cabinet of a president.
Mm-hmm.
Since Lyndon Johnson, there has always been a black person in every presidential candidate, even those presidents who said that they were against affirmative action. Is that accidental? Of course it's not accidental. It's because everyone, conservatives included, know that we must have racial diversity in our major institutions, if for no other reason than to inculcate some sense of legitimacy in these institutions.
Stuart Taylor, what's on the line in this case? What did you hear yesterday?
Well, I do agree that, as Joan said in the first place, it's likely to be a narrow decision, and for some of the reasons she gave and some others, it's not the best case in the world to put forth the problems with affirmative action. It's almost moot because she's already graduated from the University of Louisiana.
Louisiana State University.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Louisiana State. Mm-hmm. But I hope the court will take seriously, in the way it rules on the case, some of the points it's made before that have not been taken very seriously before, and that have been generally ignored by the universities. I'll mention four things the court has held in past decisions. Race-conscious admissions program may not unduly harm members of any racial group. We contend, of course, that it harms members of every racial group. Universities have the burden of demonstrating that before turning to racial classifications, race-neutral alternatives don't suffice. Very few universities have done much, although Texas has done more than most. Racial balancing, meaning trying to have proportionate representation, is patently unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has held that. And enshrining a permanent justification for racial preference is unconstitutional. Every university in the country just about is planning to continue racial preferences more or less forever, as far as I can say.
But if it were reversed, are you saying that it would be all right if we came to Randall Kennedy's vision or dystopic vision of heading back toward very white campuses? And
I was just getting to that.
Yes,
I respectfully agree with Randy on that. And here's the evidence. The racial preference and admissions have already been banned by referendum in California and Michigan and other states. They have not returned us to almost all white. In fact, there's a lot of good news about what happened in California after they banned racial preferences in 1996. Graduation rates for blacks and Hispanics went way up. Science retention rates went way up. There are more black graduates after 2009, after the dust had settled, than there are now. There was a downward transfer.
Stuart Taylor, hold the thought if you'd be kind enough. We have a short break right here. Stuart Taylor, author of Mismatch, Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School, Joan Biskupic with Reuters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They are engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Get $50 toward any mattress by visiting casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive this special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about affirmative action before the Supreme Court, again, race and college admissions front and center there at a time when race is such a hot issue on U.S. college campuses. Joan Biskupic is with us, legal affairs editor at Reuters. She was in the courtroom yesterday for oral arguments. Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School is here, author of For Discrimination. Stuart Taylor is with us, co-author of Mismatch, maybe cited at least thematically by Justice Antonin Scalia yesterday. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Do we still need affirmative action? Have you thought we'd be past the need for affirmative action by now? Are we? You've seen what's going on campuses. There's another snippet from University of Missouri. This is Ruben Faluji talking with station KSDK in St. Louis about life for minority students on campus.
If you're different, if you're not white, male, Christian, conservative, you get treated differently.
So have diversity, goes the argument, so that America gets to understand itself. Here's Justice Sonia Sotomayor saying in an interview with CBS a couple of years ago that affirmative action played a critical role in her admittance to Princeton, offered her own life and success story as an example of what is good about affirmative action. Justice Sotomayor.
The affirmative action of today is very different than it was when I was going to school. And each school does it in a different way. I can't pass judgment on whether there's a role for it or not without it being seen as I'm making a comment on an existing case. But I do know that for me, it was a door opener that changed the course of my life.
Justice Sotomayor, and she will be among the eight. Justice Kagan has recused herself from her participation in an earlier case. In this case, Stephanie in Austin, Texas. Thank you for calling, Stephanie. Right back in the lap of UT. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My comment is that being the mother of two adult children who are both college graduates, I think that affirmative action is actually causing divisions at this point. Why do we even have those little check boxes that says, you know, what is your race? My children don't see race. They have friends of all different ethnicities, and it just does not matter to them. And the previous caller from Austin had mentioned, you know, how his son thought it was unfair if he got in rather than someone else because of his ethnicity. I think that is the generation now, is that we're causing more division by dividing people up by race when, you know, kids these days don't seem to see it as people did back in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s when, you know, when I was growing up.
Yeah, Stephanie, we've got it. Let me take it to my panel, if I may. Joan, was that view worked over before with the court yesterday? It may actually be causing division or problems.
Well, I can tell you right now that Chief Justice Roberts does believe that it causes conflict, and he has famously said that the way to stop race discrimination is to stop discriminating on race. But Justice Sotomayor, who you poignantly quoted a few seconds ago, totally disagrees and says the way to stop discrimination is to confront it, to talk about it, to have these kinds of programs. So there's it may be generational in some communities, but I have to say at the court, it's not generational because those two justices are both close in age. It's just a really different way of looking at how to solve this very serious social dilemma with the chief. And I would say Justices Scalia, Alito, and Clarence Thomas clearly believing that racial classifications go to no good end, but the more liberal justices believing that it's very important still.
Stuart Taylor, on the court, I mean, you're putting forward a view, I guess, that says let's push affirmative action off the table. Do you see this court potentially ready to do that or move in that direction with this case?
Not very far, but maybe a little bit. And I hope they'll push racial preferences off the table as much as they can.
What's the evidence that they might?
The evidence that they might is that justice is that there's four people who are four conservative justices who are clearly do it, and Justice Kennedy's clearly uncomfortable with racial preferences. Whether how far he's going to take that is unclear. But I'd like to briefly respond to Justice Sotomayor on affirmative action. If the kind of affirmative action I believe in, which is for people who have been raised underprivileged but have shown a lot of potential, Justice Sotomayor would clearly have gotten into Princeton. It's not a racial preference. Underprivileged, that's not a racial preference.
So you'd have class preferences.
The best alternative to racial preferences is class preferences. And if we had had the kind of class preferences that I would support, Justice Sotomayor would have gotten into Princeton with flying colors because she had a stellar high school record. And so I think it's a false choice that she presents between, you know, turning her down and having racial preferences. She did not need a racial preference to get in. She could have gotten in on a class-based preference.
What about the argument that too many underprivileged and minority students are relegated to poor schools, bad schools in this country, so that they, even if you went to class, they would not have the schools in elementary school, high school that would help them, you know, act on their perhaps native talents to show their potential?
They are relegated bad schools in a lot of cases, but these are not the people for whom racial preferences are used. By and large, the people who receive racial preferences go to pretty good schools and often to stellar schools, often to the best private schools in the country because the universities want the people who've got the best chance of doing academically.
You're talking about the middle, upper middle, or above minority students.
Yeah. If you're talking about kids stuck in bad ghetto schools, they're not going to college, period. They're not in the game as far as racial preferences are concerned. I think it's terrible. It's a huge social problem. The solution to it is to improve our schools. It's not to torture the admissions process in college.
Let's go to Roger in Portland, Oregon. Roger, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to say first that I am a graduate of the University of Texas twice over.
Great.
Both my bachelor's and my master's. I am a Latino.
Okay.
First generation. And what I'd like to say first, that there are alternatives to being accepted first to the University of Texas. Some of those are the summer entry programs. There's also the option to spend a year at another or sister institution and transfer over, which a lot of people who do not get into the University of Texas take that option.
Yep.
I took that option.
Yeah.
So I think, and Abigail Fisher, I believe, had that option as well. And so, you know, I have to question to what degree of entitlement that we might be seeing. And also, we have to remember these are predominantly white institutions. You know, this idea that, well, you know, my kids don't. You had a caller who said my kids don't see race. You know, that is, it's not irrelevant, and I applaud this generation that's coming in after us because I think that they're less tolerant to that. But, you know, one has to question what that means, and we understand that there are racially biased or racially discriminatory structures.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, I don't agree with this. Well, they don't care about race. Well, of course, they don't socially care about race, but the institutions around them absolutely do.
So do you think race should continue to be a factor in admissions, race consciousness, as a Latino watching this with experience in Texas, Roger?
I'll add this caveat that, you know, I speak for myself. And what I would like to say is that we should see the holistic approach. I believe in UT's holistic approach. I agree that that there are various factors that need to be taken. You're talking about a meritocracy, in which case, we made the comment that any decision is going to be unfair, and that's true.
Because it's subjective, you mean, or what? Why unfair?
Well, the caller who had the, you know, half black, half white son versus somebody, let's say, who's white and saying, you know, yeah, that, I feel that's unfair that I would win over my race. It's like, but, you know, if there's a pool of thousands of candidates, you know, the majority of those are going to be disappointed by that rejection letter. So I think that we do need to consider this. I think that it does give people the capacity to advance themselves. It certainly, you know, from my personal experience, has given me the capacity to advance myself and to continue to advance myself. So I think that it should be considered. I don't think that I would appreciate sort of only being looked at as a brown guy on campus.
Yep.
because that's certainly, I think, more damaging to my mentality than anything else. Just walking around thinking, well, I only got in because of my race.
But keep it in as a factor. Roger, I'm so grateful for your call, and congratulations on both those degrees. Randall Kennedy, where are we headed here? Where, by your light, should we be headed? You hear Stuart Taylor saying, look, a whole lot of those who do get in with affirmative action or race consciousness are upper middle class from minority families, kids. Here's Roger. He worked his way in. He found the way, but he still thinks, as a Latino, that race factor should be in there somewhere.
Couple things. Number one, with respect to Stu Taylor's comments, we're talking about a Supreme Court decision involving the constitutionality of these programs. Mm-hmm. Now, that means whether they're going to be allowed or not, period, whether they're fine-tuned or what have you.
Yep.
You know, affirmative action, we have a huge country. We have many institutions. I'm sure that some affirmative action programs are not designed optimally. On the other hand, I'm sure that some affirmative action programs are designed very well. The question is, should they be allowed? It's really interesting that conservatives who are all, you know, who in other instances are attacking activist Supreme Courts, they're talking about, you know, shouldn't local politics decide our policy? Well, what about this? The people of Texas could do away with this program if the people of Texas wanted to do away with it. The people of Texas are allowing it. Shouldn't it be allowed? Shouldn't, you know,
you're making a states' rights argument?
Well, it's a question of just regular local politics. We shouldn't have the courts saying, as a matter of constitutional law, no, you cannot do this.
But flip that around. That's the argument that was made for white supremacy for years decades.
The question is this invidious racial discrimination? No, it's not. The idea that Abigail Fisher is being discriminated against because of her race is absolutely ludicrous. My second point,
yes,
the
sir.
Supreme Court of the United States has done us a tremendous disservice. We are not even talking about this in a real way. You know, the fact that we're talking about this in terms of educational policy, that's not the real basis for affirmative action.
What's the real deal? What is it?
The real basis for affirmative action is an effort to repair all of the decades, the centuries of racial oppression. It is an effort to bring into the mainstream of American life people who have been marginalized, people who've been oppressed.
But the decision that put us away from that is 40 years in the rearview mirror, isn't
I'm
it?
Sorry?
The decision that said no to that justification is far behind us now,
yes, it's far behind us. That's what Lewis Powell said in Bakke. And over and over and over again, the Supreme Court has, you know, followed that. And we have not been allowed to talk the real deal with respect to affirmative action.
We're talking affirmative action right here before the U.S. Supreme Court. Byron in Nashville, Tennessee. Byron, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Panel, briefly. Well, we see the results of overturning affirmative action or racial preferences in the job market. During the recession, black people were hurt and hit the hardest. We see that when white America is given an opportunity to choose whether or not they want to include, they don't include us. I'm a black American.
Okay.
And in the job market, during the recession, black America was hurt. Hello?
Yes, we're right here. We're listening closely.
Okay. And this is in the community structure, in neighborhoods we're excluded. When given the choice, they will exclude us. The only place black Americans will be represented in colleges is on the football field or on the basketball court, if they're given the opportunity to exclude us. So I believe in racial preferences. We fought for that. I believe in affirmative action, and we are not inferior. And we will fare well at university campuses if given the opportunity.
Byron, we've got it, and you make the case clearly and well. And my time is just short here, but I'm very glad for that input right there. Joan Biskupic, can you describe the range of outcomes possible in this case before the court now?
Sure. It boils down to just about, we could have many permutations of it, but there'd be three. The first one would be that they deadlock 4-4, and if they do that, That naturally would affirm the lower court ruling that favored the University of Texas, but it would set no national policy. So
but race consciousness would remain as part of their formula.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It would sort of just keep the status quo because they wouldn't be able to do anything else but affirm by a divided vote. They could get a majority to actually uphold the program. We'll have to see if they can do that. They could get a majority to not comment on the merits of the program but send it back for another hearing, or they could get a majority to actually strike down the program. So they're going to vote on Friday in their private conference. 8 of the justices will be around the table, and then they'll have a back and forth as they distribute their draft opinions, and I would guess that we wouldn't see a ruling until May or June.
Stuart Taylor, what's your hope out of this case?
I hope the court will move toward what it said in 2003, which is ending all racial preferences within 20 years of 2003, which is getting pretty close.
25 years, I think they said.
25 years, mm-hmm. Did I say? Yeah. And if I could add, I don't think the job market is rigged against men because they lost jobs more than women did during the Great Recession, and I don't think it's rigged on race either. I think Randy makes a good point on why should the Supreme Court dislodge the democratic process here. It's a strong point. I used to believe it. I've changed my mind because I think although the discrimination against Abigail Fisher is not in the same category with the kind he's talking about, it's still, I think, poisonous to our society, and it doesn't work because it doesn't help the people it's supposed to help.
Randall Kennedy, your hope on this case from this court?
I hope that the Supreme Court will affirm the lower court and keep affirmative action in place, because I think affirmative action, though it has problems, has been good for the United States. As Americans, we should be proud of the progress we have made over the past half century, and we should continue to make that progress.
Justice Kennedy going to back you up on that? He's the swing vote. He's the decider here, I guess.
Yeah, he is the decider, and unfortunately, I don't have a lot of confidence in him.
If it goes the other way?
If it goes the other way, frankly, diversity is here to stay despite what the Supreme Court says, and that's the good news.
Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School, author of For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stuart Taylor, author, co-author with Richard Sander of Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Stuart Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks to you and to Randy and to Joan.
Joan Biskupic at Reuters, you're always terrific. Thanks so much, Joan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.